pretty rough.
Had we not, it was a modest program, had we not provided that assistance. And it wasn't the assistance so much because it was frankly nickel dime stuff. But it was the fact that the Indonesian military were trained in the United States or trained by U.S. people there and all the rest. And it not been for that Indonesian with 140 million people. Far more important than all of Indochina put together, because it's 1,000 miles of islands lying across that whole area of the world. And it's 14 miles from the Philippines. It's the gateway to Australia. Indonesia today would be coming. Colton, what happened? Does this mean that Suharto is called Indonesian? Military leaders is thereby very great man creator for the United States. No, I think he's very decent doll. The rest, I don't know about the corruption. That seems to be quite endemic to that part of the world. And there's no reflection. And Melly, who is, as you know, I'm also an enormously able man, but leans more to the economic side. But the point that I made is that in Indonesia, looking back to that little bit of history, frankly, the Kennedy administration was right, and those of us who criticized them were wrong. It was important for the United States to continue a program of military assistance in Indonesia at that time, or Indonesia would be gone like that.
Mr. President, I just want to make one more comment about South Korea. The fact is that when we withdrew 20,000 men from South Korea, we told them that we'd help them modernize their forces. But at the same time, we encouraged them to have discussions with the North Koreans. That program is succeeding. And if we continue to give reasonably modest support, I think, to South Korea, I think we'll have more influence in getting them to negotiate a successful inclusion with the North Koreans. They were very fearful of even having any talks with them. I think those talks are going to succeed. It's going to take a long time. But the fact that they know that they are getting support from us, that we're not going to move out all of our troops quickly, gives them reasonable confidence so they can negotiate with the North. And I think that's very, very important. So again, it's not a matter of providing just military equipment. It's a matter of providing enough assurance to them by way of military equipment modernization so that they can work some of these things out with their neighbors, and then we can withdraw from there gradually, not repeat the mistakes that we made in the past. And I think there again it's working. Mr. President, I thought maybe that...
I just wanted to ask a question, Bill. Does this proposal call for $3 billion incorporate all of the construction systems that you intend?
There's nothing in here in Vietnam. I'll tell you why. The reason there's nothing in it is that the North Vietnamese doer, I mean, the condition for even considering, or we're back in the country, for even considering or ever presenting the leaders any proposal for reconstruction for North Vietnam is if they comply with the peace agreement. They're in violation in three areas. Others as well. One, they have not withdrawn their forces from Cambodia. Two, they have not withdrawn their forces from Laos. And third, in addition to that, they have not complied with the provisions with regard to the cooperation with the teams that have been set up for our MIAs. A lot of you have questions on that and you wonder about it. Believe me, until they comply, I will never ask the Congress for one penny for North Vietnam. They comply with the agreement, or there will be no question.
But this has to be about reconstruction systems from Cambodia, Laos, and South Vietnam.
Laos, Cambodia, and South Vietnam. That's right.
That's it.
So the only supplemental that we'd be reply to requests is the only question for North Vietnam, but at the moment, it certainly doesn't look like we're going to have to face that problem.
Well, Mr. President, prior to recent Indochina trip, I took on this very question. I went to see the Secretary General of the UN, ambassadors to Japan and France, Great Britain, Canada, West Germany, to ascertain their attitudes about assistance, reconstruction, post-war reconstruction assistance. And each country was not only willing, but rather eager to contribute substantially, or I should say, Great Britain said it could contribute substantially, but it contributed to the real good with other countries, particularly Japan. And I went and saw Tanaka in Japan on the same subject, and all of them wanted to contribute. I'm just wondering how much have we done to ascertain what these other countries would do so that we could get on with multilateral assistance and decrease the American dollar that has to be put into this trip.
Yes. Senator, we have talked to every nation that has shown any interest at all in this, and it is true that there is a willingness to contribute. I think that the willingness is maybe overstated sometimes in private conversations, but there is a willingness to contribute. For example, a community talks about making contribution and the outgoing and so forth. When it gets down to talking about dollars, they're all pretty careful. But anyway, answer your question.
It's happening $30 million. Now, wartime gave me a big help in the hand, present time committed. Japan was much more than $30 million at the time. They said they were actually ready to give on a non-discriminatory basis.
Well, let me say, we are doing everything we can to encourage them to actually be prepared to make the most possible, the largest possible contribution. And we've talked to all of them. We've talked to the Japanese, and of course, we've talked to the community. We've talked to Canada and others. So we've had discussions throughout the world on this subject. The question, of course, is how much the North Vietnamese will accept from these countries. For example, Japan, as Henry knows, as others, there's a very great reluctance to on the part of the North Vietnamese to accept. And also, there's a great reluctance on the part of the North Vietnamese, maybe it's more than reluctance, refusal so far to accept anything through the United Nations hostage system.
Do the other countries, Bill, predicate their willingness to make these contributions based on living up to the agreement by the North Vietnamese or not?
Well, we've been talking to them on that basis, so I'm not sure. I think in some cases they'd be willing to contribute in any of that, but we've been talking to them on the basis of living up to the agreement.
Bill, my question was that taken into consideration when your estimates, how much money could come from other sources? Would that induce your estimate if we did get substantial money?
The Joint Economic Commission is studying the requirements of North Vietnam and Morty William Stoop, who's the chief chairman of our delegation, is one of the most experienced men, probably the most experienced man we have in the reconstruction field. He's taking into account the total requirements. We have the right of the biggest because we have now suspended the talks due to the violation of the agreement. The way the Joint Economic Commission has proceeded is for the North Vietnamese to state their needs in various fields on a 5-year basis so that we could then design a 1-year at a time program taking into account the availability of all other sources, but we've never reached a point yet where we could put it all together because we've suspended the negotiations, but the intention would be to take all other contributions. So that before we made any request to the Congress, we would certainly take into account all the other possible contributors, and we would advise the Congress about what the extent of those contributions might be.
Right, and we would put before the Congress the whole study that this Joint Economic Commission does so that the Congress can judge by itself in categories. Both the requirement and the contributions of others.
Bill, may I ask, how soon will a whole package come up, excluding, of course, the North Vietnamese? Is it coming up today or tomorrow?
Tomorrow. All right. Mr. President, we haven't asked John Hannah to say a few words about the...
Before we leave what Ed's point, let me speak in general to the point. You've heard me say many times, including in your state of Massachusetts many years ago, that the United States for too long has carried the major share of furnishing not only the weapons, but the lives and the money to keep peace in the world. And now that the nations that we have helped rebuild, like Japan, like Europe, are now able to help, depending on their tails and start helping. And believe me, in the conversations I have with Braun, and the conversations I have with Tanaka, and all these people, it's going to be some lot of cold, dirty talk. You're absolutely right. When you say that, it's because they don't all have to do this without the UN. Can't deliver many times, but what you have to do here is that we have to, on a bilateral basis, talk to these countries and say, now look here, we're doing this, you ought to do this, or otherwise we can't do certain things you want. And that's what we're going to do. But I couldn't agree more that the burden, it isn't just there, you see, it's all over the world, that the burden of assisting those so-called underdeveloped countries. The burden, as a matter of fact, in some of these areas that are potential explosive areas, the burden should not be that borne solely by, or shall we say, almost totally by the United States. Now, what we have to bear in mind, of course, is another point. We do not want to get that burden moved in a way that will bring, shall we say, interests into an area that might serve not the cause of peace, but the cause of war. When somebody suggests, well, now, in terms of the rebuilding of South Vietnam, why don't the Russians come in and help? South Vietnamese don't want to say that we. That would not be in our interest, or it wouldn't be in theirs. As a matter of fact, the Russians aren't too keen on us helping the North Vietnamese. So, in other words, there is a foreign policy point here, too. But with regard to your point, with regard to multilateral, and, well, putting it another way, multinational participation in this is a major goal of this foreign policy. It's a fundamental tenet of the Nixon government. We'll help countries that help themselves, in fact. And we expect other nations with capabilities that we have helped them develop to do their share. And they aren't doing it today. You're absolutely right. And that's what it is here. Does that get to the heart of the question?
Isn't this? But I just don't think that'll encourage people who see us doing it alone.
You bet your life. Neither do I. Neither do I. Well, John, would you like to take off your giveaway programs?
President, I want to talk about development assistance. This is a very complicated subject. We're here this morning because the Senate and the President is sending the former for today or tomorrow. The authorization of the bill for foreign assistance. And foreign assistance has in it, of course, military assistance and military sales and not just that supporting assistance as well as foreign aid. You all remember that the government of foreign assistance was missed at the end of World War II, when it was clearly in our interest to help the people of Western Europe restore their economic, social, political systems. The Marshall Plan was a great success. People spent a lot of time, a lot of money, a great many very able people were at it, and it was expanded to Japan before it was finished in Western Europe. After the Marshall Plan was a success, and it was clear that the colonial powers were going to have to release their colonies and make them independent if they wanted to become independent. Mr. Truman looked at the world and served the two-thirds of all the people of the world at that time, lived in what he called the underdeveloped countries. He proposed in the inaugural address for the term which he was elected, the fourth point in the address was a suggestion to the Congress that they make it possible for him to make available to the poor countries, the underdeveloped countries, American expertise and know-how, technical assistance, to help them help themselves if they wanted to. It was to be on a request basis. It was a very simple people-to-people operation.
All of you will remember who attended that inaugural, or anybody bought a top hat for Dewey's inaugural, and we all sat there and heard Truman talk about point four.
As time went on, and the communists,
the guy who was Dewey's manager, so they called him.
Republic, which is only they had aspirations to control Asia. It was natural that what started out as point four in Orleans began to be concerned with military assistance, helping the countries surrounding the communist world help themselves resist communism if they would. That's how MAT, military assistance, foreign military sales, got the foreign assistance aid. In the Kennedy administration, when the decision was made to reorganize, but at point four had already been reorganized half a dozen times, into what is now AID, and I don't know this, but I suspect, reading everything that's available to read, that when the decision was made to the Defense Department to fight the war, they looked around the federal government and found that in what had been AID, the point four successor agencies, which was then Technical Cooperation Administration, had a substantial number of people that had a good deal of experience in operations overseas. So the decision was made that everything in Vietnam that wasn't military would be handled by AID. But it wasn't going to call AID, that it would be called supporting assistance. And the definition for supporting assistance was those programs prosecuted in the interest of the United States that had military or short-range political objectives. But it wouldn't be mixed up in so-called point four development assistance if we separated, defended to the Congress on that basis. Now in the new bill, as in the old bills in recent years, there is military assistance involving military sales and supporting assistance, which is intended to now transform into reconstruction and rehabilitation and humanitarian assistance for South Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and maybe North Vietnam and other dangerous pieces. Well, this thing now that we talk about is development assistance, people assistance. It's complicated. It's technical assistance, it's development loans, it's disaster relief, it's PL4E, it's carried in the budget of agriculture, but it's actually handled in the countries by AID, more on hunger and food for peace. It's the harnessing of the voluntary agencies, the church groups and CARE, and all the other agencies that are involved in relief of distressed people or poor people scattered all over the world. The financing of what of the UN agencies that are not in the assessment categories, UNDP and WHO and FAO and UNFPA and so on, they're a section of this bill. Well, I suspected that when we got to talk about development assistance, there wouldn't be many minutes left, and that's where we are. So instead of spending a lot of time rambling over, and then I'm going to get back to the State Department, remembering that I left out what I wanted to say, I think you get the job done better if I'll stick to about 6 or 8 minutes that I have here and try to cover what I would like to put before you this morning. Foreign aid legislation traveled a rocky road with the government. Foreign aid legislation traveled a rocky road in Congress last year and was again caught up in issues and controversies not directly related to the foreign aid program. We face the beginning of a new fiscal year just 2 short months away, and there has to be an authorization for all that is foreign assistance, development, military, supporting assistance, or whatever. The fact that nearly 3/4 of the world's total population, in Truman's day, it was 2/3,
Now it's about three quarters of all the people dispersed live in the less developed countries. And gentlemen, they will continue to be a determinant of the world's political and economic condition, a major determinant. We in the United States cannot achieve our aspirations for a peaceful world community and an expanding economy in isolation from them. Despite substantial economic progress in many of the poor countries during the past decade, their common condition is poverty. The gains that have been made have been unevenly distributed or too often overwhelmed by population growth.
If I could add one thing, John Bailey, the fine, decent humanitarian man that you are, you have mentioned, of course, all these humanitarian considerations, not only the two-thirds of the people in the world is there, but in terms of the world's raw materials, in terms of the world's energy, in terms of the things that we need, two-thirds of it is also there.
In terms of the world's markets, the part of the world, we've got to take a little trade balance.
Not much they can buy, but an awful lot we can buy from them. You realize that our interests are not simply all that way, and it doesn't make points, particularly with them. They're pretty realistic.
That's the countries that face.
I say a country like Indonesia. Sure, Indonesia is poor, and Indonesia gets more out of the aid than we do. But on the other hand, Indonesia is an enormously rich country. It's the vice president before I return from his trip. Enormously rich from the standpoint of its natural resources.
Common condition is poverty, the gains that have been made have been unevenly distributed or too often overwhelmed by unchecked population growth. Too generally, the gaps have grown between the political and economic elites, which have benefited from modernization, and a much larger group of rural peasants and urban laborers, and they remain trapped in conditions of severe deprivation. Half the people of all the countries in the poor world are really poverty stricken. By a measure of poverty that we don't think about in this country. Trade, investment, and critical resource needs, as mentioned by the President. Through those items, the welfare of the United States and the other industrialized nations are linked to the welfare of the people of the LDCs. We share with them a common interest in an open international economic system in which all nations benefit from an increased flow of goods and services. The solution to world problems is environmental pollution, narcotic control, the security of travel, requires broad international cooperation, including participation of the developing countries. The development of a satisfactory international monetary exchange system requires their participation and cooperation. For all of these moral, economic, and political reasons, a continuing U.S. response to the challenge of development is as much in our own interest as it is in that of the developing nations. The appropriate response to the challenge is a system of technical, institutional, economic relationships between the industrialized countries and the poor countries. And much of the machinery for this joint systematic approach is in place and includes agencies of the UN and the international lending institutions and the U.S. bilateral programs and the bilateral assistance programs of the other 16 major aid-giving countries. Now, AID is a key element in this system. Our bilateral aid program is a flexible, innovative tool which can meet unique U.S. purposes more directly, more quickly, and more effectively than can other modes of assistance. And more importantly, it seeks to meet the basic human needs of masses of poor people in the poor countries. It provides a channel for U.S. leadership, a clear identification of U.S. participation, and a visible demonstration of U.S. constancy and dependability. The international development assistance system now in place, both bilateral and multilateral, is functioning more effectively each year. The Peterson Committee reform plan recommended by the administration in 1971 was not approved by the Congress. In late 71, AID undertook a major internal review to develop a program based on current realities. And the resulting changes were put into effect beginning in 1972, and they are part of the fiscal 74 program. The plan provides for a tighter, more responsive AIE program characterized by a more collaborative style of assistance, concentration on a few key human problems, food production and nutrition, population planning and health, education and human resource development, and public administration. Increased emphasis on innovative research, increased attention to the growing problems of unemployment, increased participation of U.S. private organizations in project planning, evaluation, and implementation, better integration of technical capital and food assistance, and a reduced U.S. governmental presence and profile overseas. AIB has made substantial progress in implementing these reforms. The Fiscal 74 program builds upon and accelerates the pace of that progress. At the height of the independent development in 1968, the total direct hire AID worldwide staff reached a high of almost 18,000 persons. This level has been reduced to 14,400 at the end of fiscal 70, 13,400 at the end of 71, 11,700 at the end of 72, 10,800 now, and is scheduled to decrease to 9,900 in fiscal 74. Overall reduction of almost 50%. Substantial additional reductions can be accomplished through the approval of the recommendations in today's legislation to include AID career Foreign Service employees under the terms of the Foreign Service Retirement. Provisions that now cover state and AID personnel. This would encourage AID employees who are eligible to retire to do so, and would move the mandatory retirement age from the present 70 years with 15 years of service. If a man is 70 years old but hasn't been on the job 15 years and wants to stay, he can. The change to the normal retirement age of 60 with possible extension to the age of 65 on a person-to-person basis. The Authorization Act voted by the House last year included a similar provision. The Senate did not finally act on the authorization bill. One of the Secretary Rogers made that this is a very modest program that's going forward today. It represents a reduction of over 20% from our request for current year funding. The development request is almost a third below that of last year. I'm talking about my possibility of funding. It's $50 million below what we've actually received under the terms of the continuing resolution. We do not believe that this level of bilateral funding responds adequately to the needs of the less developed world, but it represents the judgment as to what we should provide in light of the federal government's overriding need to economize its operations. The only new thrust of the aid program in fiscal 74 concerns the 25 least developed countries, the 25 poorest countries. All of the multinational and bilateral aid programs have agreed to increase their emphasis on assistance and encouragement to the world's poorest 25 countries. Not about the UN and all the bilateral aid programs and the lending agencies are all part of this program. AID intends to increase its emphasis, first in those poorest countries where we already have substantial programs, Haiti and Afghanistan and Nepal and Ethiopia, Sudan and Tanzania, Yemen, and in regional programs covering the other African countries. The second change is the one that's been mentioned by Secretary Rogers and the President. The continuation of economic assistance is proposed for South Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia to permit a sound beginning in the process of rehabilitation, reconstruction, and humanitarian assistance. Assistance to the thousands of refugees as a high priority, as well as the restoration of essential community services in the worst. I'd like to conclude by just citing some simple statistics that illustrate what we're talking about. These are the best statistics that we can get on the population of the world and the production of the world. 73.9%, roughly 74% of all the people in the world live in the poor countries, the developing countries. If you want them broken down, free world versus the communist world, it's 49.5% in the free world and 24.4% in the communist world. 26.1% of the people on Earth live in the developed countries. Western Europe, the United States,
and China. Let me ask you this, that 29%, that includes China.
China is put in the developing.
Right.
Russia and right. Eastern Europe,
of course. Are developed. But I mean, so you get your 29%, that's how such a high figure, because you include 800 million people in China, which is the fourth Russia and Eastern Europe, like Romania, et cetera, et cetera, is developing countries, but we do consider China. China, one, that's 25% of all people, and then the other 4% gets you 29, so that doesn't count.
And I'm developing countries.
Because I was sure I had this 10 minutes to say anything, I've got copies of this in Japan. Now, 26% that live in the developed countries, 9.2% are continents, that's Russia and Eastern Europe. 5.5% in the United States, and 11.4% in the other developed countries, Western Europe, Canada, Australia, Japan, and so on. Now that's the population. Now what about the world's production? The world's production is divided, I was talking about the poor countries first. 20.4% in the developing countries, of which 4.4% is communist. Or 74% of the world's people are responsible for 20.4% of the world's total production, industrial, agricultural, and everything else. 79.6% of the world's production is in the developed countries. And if you want to break it down, it's 27.6% in the United States, 33.3% in the other developed countries of the free world, and 18.7% in the communist countries, Russia and Eastern Europe. Leaving that, only people are important. After now better than 4 years, I've been your aid administrator longer than any man since the beginning of 24. All that demonstrates is that I have a fit tie in the Tom spirit, I wouldn't think it. But I'm satisfied that only people are important in your hometown, in your county, in your state, or in our country, or in any of the communities of the countries on earth. Everything else is only a means of providing better lives for people, poorer lives. Human problems do not stay bottled up behind national borders. Uncontrolled human reproduction vitally affects the well-being of all nations. Diseases ignore national boundaries. Polluted air and polluted water flows freely between countries. Now, I talk to people around the country, and they begin to talk about a throwaway program, and why should we spend anything overseas when we have city problems, place problems, and all kinds of problems at home. I find that really, when you get down to town, why are you interested in? The average person in this country is more interested in what's life going to be like in my hometown, in my county, in my state, in my country, for my children, or if he's an older person like I am, and talk about your grandchildren. That's what you're interested in. What's it going to be like? Well, my children and grandchildren and yours must live in the same world with the children and grandchildren of all the peoples, of all the continents, all the colors, and all religions. And I'm just as certain as I'm sitting here talking to you this morning that what life in the United States will be like for my grandchildren and yours depends very largely on what the world will be like in the decades ahead. The United States has got to be a part of the world, and there isn't any way you can separate yourself from it. And if your only interest is a selfish interest, satisfactory level economic development for the United States, you've got to have markets. And as the President mentioned, you've got to have raw material. And as our experts tell us, if in 1985 we're going to be buying 30 plus billions of dollars of petroleum from the countries, largely the Arab countries, or anywhere else, for any other place where they can find it in the world, our interests are clearly tied in having available to us what we need to maintain a decent life back home. Well, gentlemen, that's why I believe with a deep conviction that we owe it to our own interests and the future of our country begin to look seriously at the role our country is going to play in determining the kind of world this is going to be. That is what development assistance in USAID is all about. And after 4 years, I appreciate the opportunity to make this pitch to you.
I'd like to add something let's take a place that none of you really mentioned much today, Africa. Let's leave that out here, you know, Libya, the oil.
Let's just look at black Africa.
Yeah, let's just look at Africa, the continent. Take a map of the world and look at Africa. Compare it with the size of South America. Compare it with the size of Asia. And look at the number of people that are there. Not 15 years from now, not 25 years from now, perhaps not even 50 years from now, will Africa, in terms of its production, in terms of its number of people, will be a very significant force on the world scene. But 100 years from now, just because it's there, it's big, the people are going to be strong, and they're going to be vigorous, it's going to be an enormous success. And for the United States not to have some kind of a policy beginning now with Africa, even though we say, well, that's Europe's problem, you know what I mean? The French have this interest, the Belgians have this interest, and so forth. So be it. Believe me, when you look at Africa, the number of people, the resources there that nobody's even thought of you know, exploring yet. I mean, we've got to think of that now. I mean, I remember, Ed, when you and I were riding that plane back in 1967, and we talked about China. And I guess you must have thought I'd been smoking opium. That was before pot started having opium. But anyway, we talked about it. But China was there, and we knew here was a great civilization and important people in the world. We had to eventually work out a policy towards China. You and I agreed, right? And you've spoken about that. Africa, we don't need to think of it in those, shall we say, melodramatic terms at this moment. But looking way into the future, here is a huge body of land, a potentially great number of people, enormous resources, and therefore policies that at least keep the United States involved are terribly important in that part of the world. People say, why do you have Mobutu over here? Why do you have the presence of Upper Chad or all these places and so forth and so on? And the answer is not because of what's going on, it's going to affect us right now, but because there is the future. 100 years from now.
Peace is obvious. One is there's another reason why we have an interest in Africa. That is that most of the genetically Africans not in Africa are in the United States. And as our black people learn more about the history of their own people, cultural backgrounds and so on, which are pretty distinguished, they're going to have an increasing interest in, I don't know about black Africa, from the Sahara to South Africa, leaving those groups.
Well, that's far Africa.
And I'll put one more piece. One of the problems is disaster relief. Now, we got a great flood in Bangladesh, or we have an earthquake in Managua, or one in Peru, or something else. And of course, there's a great interest in disaster relief, and interest in money, not in our funding, to go to the Congress to be generous and provide. You mentioned those black African countries. There are six of those countries, starting with part of Senegal, part of Mauritania, and Upper Mauritania, and Niger, and around to Chad, and I've left out one or two, but I've got one there, should there other. It's a very substantial area that's going desert. The Sahara is moving south substantially every year. It's almost a desert now. There are only 18 or 20 million people there. They're going to starve. Their only economic input has been livestock, and there is no feed left for them. And now the problem is that the livestock are going to do those people. They're practically the total population for six countries. Well, you know, no one has any great interest in this, but we ought to have a real interest. I just put that in because we not only have the interest in the future, I'm sure, but what are we going to do with this very large part of geography that unless history reverses itself, desert begins to recede, somebody ought to be concerned with it, and we ought to be concerned.
Good job, that's the best as I would say. Well, now, let me say that I do receive the transfer from the House, and I'd like to hear
speak to your bill, Mr. President. I thought we ought to get on with the business till I speak tomorrow. The hearing starts tomorrow.
Well, we hope we beat you to the wire.
How much of this job that we started out doing under Point 4 is now being done by international lending organizations?
Substantial part of it. And on the bilateral programs, about 40% of the United States and about 60% of the other Gulf countries will be getting it wrong.
Well, when we talk about international lending ones too, Carl, let's remember, that's half the U.S. I mean, you know, that's why, that's when our friend, you know, all that talks about all this international stuff is to remember 60% U.S. That's all right.
You know, something like that, which is...
Well, it's close enough, you agree.
It varies from about 25% and lower and stuff, much more than 100%.
Right, right. But I, the other thing I would like to say is this, I'm aware too that Otto Kastman believed that everything should be loans. Now, I like to, Otto isn't here, and I just made a little note to Carl, and I want to talk to him about it. I want to say to you that it won't work. I mean, we can move in that direction, but there are just many instances where loans are unpaid. That it's just cheating yourself about it. I mean, so Cambodia is going to pay back a loan. Some of these other countries that we're talking about, no way. That is why. Let me say, we support the goal, but you can't just. We shift totally from grants to loans. Second point is the multilateral versus the bilateral. Quite in some instances, bilateral is very much in the interest, the security interest of the United States because of the influence we can have. Remember that if it's multilateral, we're going to pick up the lower banner, a third of the chip, sometimes 40% of the chip. And when we pick it up, we pick up 5% of the influence. And influence has a lot to do with this too. It isn't just John would be the first to agree that these humanitarian concerns, of course, touch our hearts. And believe me, when it's an earthquake or whatever it is, let's help. You know, you mentioned Peru and you mentioned Managua. My goodness, we've helped Romania. We've helped Yugoslavia. I mean, this is a generous country. We're a good country. We're a decent country. Thank God. And I hope we always are, and I hope we can afford to be. But then you come down to the problems that all of you are aware of, I know the deep concern in Congress about the burden America carries in the world. I know my dear concern about our NATO burden. 25 years ago, you remember President Eisenhower said it was a temporary program. I remember when he agreed this all over in the Library of Congress. We were all there. I was the president of Congress, and you were a very senior. I don't know, but anyway, we were there. On that occasion, we were thinking of those things. And yet, the investment in Europe was a good investment. If it had not been for that investment and its success, there would be no negotiation with the Soviets today. They would be telling us, rather than we're mutually trying to work out the most historic limitation of arms ever between major powers in the history of the world, and the only thing that can avoid a nuclear confrontation sometime in the future. I'm going to say a word too about the NATO thing. I know it's going to come up. I know the vote's going to be tough. It's going to be tight, and so forth and so on. And I say what I said before. And many of you honestly disagree with this. I respect the disagreement. Maybe you're right. But I can only tell you this, that this fall, we are negotiating for the first time with the Warsaw Pact countries, and that includes the Soviet Union, for a balanced force reduction. You know, where we go down and they go down. Now, putting it in terms of the threat to the peace of the world, a strong United States is not going to is one of expansion. Ours is one, basically, the Nixon doctrine is, we'll help those that help themselves. And I'm simply saying this. We want a reduction of American forces in Europe. I want it desperately. I want this money available so we can have it here at home. But believe me, don't put us in the position where, before we go into those negotiations, and I realize that the bills will not pass. Mike was talking the other day before we get there anyway, and so forth. Don't put us in the position before we go into negotiations that it appears to the people on the other side that regardless of whether they go down, we're going to go down. If we do, you, all of us who participate in that, will have enormously increased the risk of war in the world. And that's it. Let's take the whole matter of the military budget. I'll speak briefly on that. I know you're very concerned about it. Believe me, if you see any places where the darn thing can be cut, I am not, I mean, in a way that will not cut our real strength. It should be cut. Trim. I don't know where it can be cut at this point. But I do know this. We're going to have negotiations with the Russians, we trust, sometime this summer, which will be infinitely more important than the ones we had last year. And most of you applauded what happened last year, you know. After all, we did have a total limitation on nuclear defense arms, and we agreed with it. And we have a temporary limitation on offensive weapons. Let me say, this is going to be a very, very tough negotiation. We're in the preliminary talks now. Those talks are going to go forward and all of us are going to participate. The decision will be made at the time that they're here. When I say the decision on their part, of course, the decision on our part is always going to be submitted back to you. But I can assure you this, I sat across the table from these people. They don't give you a thing if they think they can get it without giving something up. In other words, they don't give you a thing unless you've got something that they want to get from you. That's what it gets down to. Now, what do I mean by that? Am I saying that we should huff and puff, build all sorts of huge nuclear arsenals and so forth, and as a result we start at a higher plateau and this frees it up there? I'm not suggesting that at all. We're at a low plateau at the present time. But we're in a historic moment in the history of the country, believe me. In 1972, and let's leave the politics out, because let me say, I am very grateful for the fact that Mike, Carl, and many of the rest of you, along with Terry, and Bob, and others who are no longer here, strongly supported what we did. But look how the world has changed. There was no communication at all with one-fourth of the people. A quarter of a century. If we allowed that to continue, it would have affected us 5 years, not 10 years, not 20 years, but 20 years, 25 years from now. The People's Republic of China, not because they're communist, but because they're Chinese, would be an enormous threat to the peace of the world. And it's much better for us to be on the inside, talking to them, negotiating, rather than the outside, isolated, confronted. And we've made that breakthrough. Let's look at the Soviet Union. When President Eisenhower sat at this desk, Bill Rogers was here then as a member of the cabinet, last cabinet meeting, the United States had a 15-to-1 advantage over the Soviet Union in nuclear arms, at least. At least. At the time of the Cuban confrontation in 1962, it was tough. It was a risk. But the advantage of the United States was 12-to-1, it now appears. There was no missile gap. The gap was the other way. And McNamara was honest enough to admit it after the campaign was over. I don't complain that he's claiming there was one, because the point was they were building and we were. speaking. The advantage we have is in our technology, and therefore, we're not afraid. But I do say this. This is, if I will not be melodramatic, just 1 minute to midnight in terms of the chance to have really not only a limitation of armament, but eventually a reduction of armament. To have a situation where the two superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union, sit down, and for a variety of reasons. For example, they may need us. They may need our wheat. They may need us in other ways. But also, basically, they are still communists. They still have their hawks as well as their guns. And this is the chance that we have to sit down and say, look here, President of the United States, some of our hawks would say, bluff them out, Mr. President. Push, tell them you push the button. Sure, I can push the button. It's right here under this door. Boy, that'll really scare them. Kill 70 million Russians. Scare me, too. Kill 70 million Americans.
All right.
And if it was attractive, you, maybe it's 40. It's enough, huh? But for them, it's not much of an option. For us, it's not much of an option. But who knows when a madman might be in one place or the other. That is why we cannot allow this to go forward. But I'm simply saying to you, the United States, unilaterally, before we make a deal with them, tells them, look, fellows, we're going to reduce, regardless of what you do. There will be no reduction on their part, because they want an advantage. And they will use that advantage. Oh, maybe not for war. But maybe in terms of disintegrating the European alliance or what have you. The same is true as far as Europe is concerned. Here's NATO. This gaggle of countries, rich, strong, all in business for themselves today, you know? Alliances are kept together, Macmillan once said to me, by not by love, but by fear. And the fear's kind of gone out of them now. No fears. Ron will say, the Russians have changed and all that sort of thing. Maybe they have. God hope that they will have. I think they have to an extent. I think they may change more. But only if we're talking to them. Only if we're negotiating with them. Only if they see that if they do not change, they confront a strong, resourceful, powerful United States that will not unilaterally say, okay, we throw in the sponge, you be stronger, and we accept it. What I'm simply saying to you gentlemen here is that whether it's in foreign aid, where all these humanitarian considerations are concerned, or whether it's anything else, I've prayed about this, as many of you have. I think of all the things that I'd love to do, the domestic deal, you know, also in. I was very interested to know, you know, and close the bases of Massachusetts, you know, right? When you close bases, people that want to cut the fences say, no, not that. But nevertheless, I understand that, too.
That's when the government has a normal rate of sentence.
I know. Yeah, but you wouldn't want to use our national defense for the purpose of kind of deployment.
Not at all.
Believe me, from a senator from Massachusetts, you did exactly the right thing, and we'll listen to you.
No,
I understand that, but what I'm simply saying is this. Let me tell you, fellas, at this time in our history, the year 1976 will determine whether we do have a permanent limitation of nuclear arms with a chance to go further and reduce, or whether that chance goes forever, and whoever occupies this chair after I leave faces the situation where he has a nation in which there is another stronger than America that has different designs in the world than we have. And second, this is the year that will determine whether, in terms of NATO, after all this great agony we've we've gone through, the billions we poured into Europe, the divisions we have of them, whether or not we reduce our forces without increasing the risk of war, without increasing the chances of disintegration of the alliance. The alliance, which is the only deterrent to the possible Soviet movement.
The reason I say this, and I will conclude my speech, the length of my speech proves that I was, should have been in the Senate, but I wasn't in the House, but I just want to say that this conclusion. If there were any way that I could advocate a smaller foreign aid budget, a smaller defense budget, we can. But right at the present time, and I think that those who have sat and talked to me at times, apart from my public statements, know that here's where my great capacity is. There is nothing in the illusion, nothing that I want more than peace and war. Nothing that I want more than to see terrible arsenals be built up, this horrible waste, go to the needs of people rather than the building up of arsenals. But also, I'm a realist. And we live in a dangerous world. And I simply say, many thought that our trip to China was a mistake. Many thought that the negotiation with Russia was a mistake. Matter of fact, George, you remember when we talked to Scoop Jackson on his book? We said, you remember the war party? Well, that's not true. Scoop is for peace, too. We all are. I hope that President Eisenhower always President Eisenhower always said, the great thing about America is that our debate is really not about war, but really about peace. And it really is. We all believe that. And let's give ourselves all that credit. Some can say those who want to disarm the bears for war, they have a great on war. Some will say those who want to build armaments want peace. That isn't true. I don't say that about John Stennis or Eddie Hebert. And we shouldn't say it about people like Mark Hatfield and others. I mean, God knows we're all in the right position. But let me say, 1972 was a good year for peace in the world. It could not have happened if America had not been strong. And I simply ask you today, give us a chance in 1973 to build on that. And if we fund it, I'll take the blame.
Well, let me say, I think there are different roads to peace, and I had a feeling Scoop was sick. Anyone on the wrong road?
I know. So, well, I'm going to thank you very much. And
a couple of things.
We do. I just want you to know that we all carry a great burden in terms of political burdens and all the rest of it. But let's just remember this meeting is and all the meetings that we have, and remember, I think it was John Hanna put it quite eloquently. It's not just us. It's the kids. It's the grandchildren. It's the great-grandchildren. And frankly, the whole hope for any peace in the world is right here. Awareness. If we don't do the job, there are others ready to do it.